I really am trying to explain the thing that I want to understand. Like, that's what I'm, even as the rise of large language models come, and I feel often that I don't always find a camp of people who see things the same way, and that can be good and sometimes challenging and can sometimes be very sort of lonely. Why can't dynamical systems represent and compute? It's a choice for us to believe that they cannot. It's a choice for us to not to try to, you know, bend or break or reformulate how we talk about these systems.
What is the dimensionality of language?
Oh, it depends on who you ask.
Sorry, is dimensionality one of those words for you?
No, do we need dimensionality that? is a safe word. It's a good word.
Hello, intrepid mind explorers. This is Brain Inspired. I'm Paul. Today, my guest is Andrea Martin, who is the research group leader in the Department of Language and Computation in Neural Systems at the Max Planck Institute and the Donders Institute. Andrea is deeply interested in understanding how our biological brains process and represent language. To this end, she is developing a theoretical model of language. And the aim of the model is to account for the properties of language, like its structure, its compositionality, its infinite expressibility, all while adhering to physiological data that we can measure from human brains. So her theoretical model of language, among other things, brings in the idea of low-dimensional manifolds and neural dynamics along those manifolds. So we've discussed manifolds a lot on the podcast, but in short, they're a kind of abstract structure in the space of possible neural population activities, the neural dynamics. And that manifold structure defines the range of possible trajectories or pathways the neural dynamics can take over time. One of Andrea's ideas is that manifolds might be a way for the brain to combine two properties of how we learn and use language and process language. One of those properties is the statistical regularities found in language. So a given word, for example, occurs more often near some words and less often near some other words. This statistical approach is the foundation of how large language models are trained. The other property of language is the more formal structure of language, how it's arranged and organized in such a way that gives it meaning to us. Perhaps these two properties of language can come together as a single trajectory along a neural manifold. And our brain's predictions about what's coming next essentially guide and push neural activity along that manifold trajectory. So that's a mouthful, I know, but we hash it out more during the episode. And she has a lot more ideas, and of course, we discuss many of them. And of course, we discuss large language models more and how Andrea thinks of them with respect to biological cognition. We talk about modeling in general and what models do and don't tell us, and much more. So as always, I hope that our discussion just whets your appetite to learn more about Andrea's work. And you can find links in the show notes at brainspired.co/podcast/169, where you can also learn how to support this podcast if your hearts are as generous as your minds are intrepid. Okay, thank you for listening. Here's Andrea. Andrea, you've been studying language for a long time. And first of all, why didn't you study vision instead of language? Oh, no, I'm just kidding.
I actually have an answer to that.
Okay, all right.
I actually started working... First, I went to college for 1 year at Columbia University, and then I dropped out. But I worked in a P53 oncogene lab, and I, you know, as like a intern, one of my tasks was to be involved in like sacrificing the animals. And at the time, I was a vegan. I'm not anymore, and I found it really rough. And I was like, I'm really interested in neuroscience. What can I study where I won't ever have to use animal models because I don't have the stomach for it? Even though I think the data are important. And that's how I ended up with language. I mean, there are many other steps in between. I ended up doing some other stuff, and then I ended up studying cognitive science at Hampshire College, where I could really focus exclusively on psycholinguistics and cognitive science.
So it really was a matter of, it's not language per se that you were interested in, and I'm sure that you've become very interested in it.
It was avoidance. No, it was. It helped me sort of like crystallize what was it about actually the human mind that I was so interested in. It's actually something that I couldn't study in an animal model. That's a different way to put it.
And this is an unfair question because I know that there are many aspects of language that you're interested in, but is there a particular aspect of language that excites you, that you're really focused in on?
I think it's for me, I mean, I think, you know, to foreshadow a bit, it's the idea that language represents sort of the boundary computation for the brain. So I can talk more about this later, but the fact that you need statistical and quote unquote algebraic or variable like information to account for our language behavior and the languages of the world, I think really sort of presses us to say, okay, what's sort of the limits on what we can express in a neural system? And language gives us a really great readout for that. And so following that line, then I guess the most sort of interesting property of language that gets to that is really the notion of compositionality, that you are putting things together that are more than the sum of their parts, but that are a function of them and the rules used to combine them. And that's really, that just seems to be endlessly giving important insights about the human mind and about the brain.
So you use the term boundary computation, I believe, there. So, and then you also use the term limits. I mean, do you think that language represents a bound on our cognitive capacities?
I think more what I mean there is, at least for what we know about language now, at least just talking about the world's languages and what linguistics tells us, we already have a really hard problem that I think neuroscience and cognitive science are like, you know, running their best race to try to explain already. But already I think there's a lot of stuff that isn't sufficient or that's sort of falling short. And that's what I mean there. So the other way to look at it more formally is to say, look, if you really want to push a system to be both statistical and algebraic, that's going to be the boundary condition on the things that you can compute for the brain.
What does it mean to say that language is algebraic?
That's a great question. So I thought about this a lot since you brought it up. And I think the way that I typically try to like get to the problem or define it for people is to say that, to start thinking about it in terms of the fact that human language is shaped by its statistics, but it's not defined by them, right? So language can break free from the statistics of itself, so frequency or probability of a sound, of a morpheme, of a word or a phrase. And if we couldn't do that, you know, notably our behavior would be really, really different, right? So it's easy to think of extreme or funny examples, like we could only say fixed responses, or we'd constantly be getting stuck in local or minima or maxima about what we're talking about or what we're saying. And we don't do that. And there, I mean, there are many classical and better examples from the cognitive revolution. The fact that we can say things that we haven't heard before, that we don't have lookup tables of utterances that we're bound to. But I think we kind of actually overlook this simple fact all the time, and that not being driven by statistics, well, then what is the thing that can explain our behavior and the way the systematicity of languages, how they work? And that seems to be minimally some kind of system that has variables at its heart. And it's from that notion that you're not stuck to a fixed value, that is, you know, a sound or a word that you heard in a particular context, that you only return that. You somehow come upon a system of rules where you can have variables and functions that then can be adapted to, you know, the conditions at hand, what you need, so you can express the thing that's needed in that situation.
Where do those rules come from?
Is a deep and contentious question.
let me back up, because what I wanted to ask, you know, just off of what you were talking about was, you know, what came first? Statistics or rules, right? Or variables. Maybe I will just ask that.
To start. So, I mean, that's already in itself has got the hard question in it. So which came first? In order to, you know, sort of a simple way to talk about statistics is to say it's counting something, right? But in order to be able to count something, you have to know what that thing is to recognize it and say, okay, you know, obviously the way that we use statistics now in natural language processing and in cognitive science is much more sophisticated. It's not just simply counting one occurrence, but still there has to be some, in practice, labeling that's going on in the engineering sense, or there has to be something built into the system that tells you, okay, this is the thing that's relevant to count, to calculate a statistic over. So in that sense, I think you have to at least have some kind of pattern recognition that allows you to extract some invariance across all the different situations that we encounter language. I mean, language learning and acquisition is not my specialty. It's a really hard problem too. But I think that it's clear that there's an interaction between, an inductive bias that we have for hierarchical relationships and patterns for looking for more than sequences, for doing more than predicting the next word, and that that can then bootstrap over the information that we get from our environment. And we do lots of, I think, interesting internal comparison between representation and context to then over time define these rules. Hmm. So in some sense, you know, the rules actually are reflected in the statistics, but the statistics don't, from them, just having the statistics alone won't give you the rules. So there's sort of this asymmetry between the sources of information.
Okay. Yeah. These are all like big problems. I want to just zoom out and back up maybe and ask how, so language has always intimidated me. I mean, I remember I took a linguistics course and it was kind of fun, but just the idea, you know, so I come from a non-human primate neurophysiology background. At studying eye movements and decision making, vision, the vision sciences, as everyone else, is 90% or something. Do you know what the percentage is? I don't even know.
No, I don't. I do know when I was a PhD student at NYU, it seemed like everybody else except for me and like my three friends worked on vision. So, yeah. So my anecdote is there's a big population of vision scientists.
Well, one of the reasons is because you know, the musculature of the eye and making eye movements, all that is like really worked out. The circuit diagram and how all that works. Yeah. And I, you know, so that makes it a somewhat more tractable.
That's appealing.
It is appealing, right? And you know, going back to my own fears about studying language, and I, you know, I've been focusing a little bit more on language recently, as we were talking just a moment ago off air, due to these large language models, and the rise in the popularity of these. So, and you know, I've had multiple people on the podcast talking about language, but I think if I I'm not sure. I feel like language. So here's the question is, I'm curious how your own view on language as an object of study and just as a cognitive process has sort of evolved over time. Has it become easier, you know, seeming like a more like an easier problem to tackle, or has it become more wily? And
No, I think it was always wily. So I do share with you that fear of language or of the enormity of the problem and the endless complexity. And for me, it's also the importance is like language is so multifaceted. So I really focus on what it means to have a structured representation that's linguistic in something like a neural system and neural dynamics. And that's, for me, that's really core and key part of language. But there's so many other parts of language that are equally important and linguistic and that are also hallmarks of the incredible human capacity of language itself. So that for me is like the source of the fear because it can become so complex and there's so many things that obviously matter to the brain. Like when we're talking to each other, you know, we can name a long list of factors that are going to be really important, including our eye movements and joint attention and all these things that lead to mutual understanding and our ability to refer to things, right? But I guess I've already sort of been comfortable with that, that complexity or that chaos of what needs to be explained for a long time. And I think over the years, I've gotten sort of more comfortable or more situated in, oh yeah, no, it really is, I really am trying to explain the thing that I want to understand. Like that's what I'm, that, you know, even as the rise of large language models come and I feel often that I don't always find a camp of people who see things the same way and that can be good and sometimes challenging and can sometimes be very sort of lonely. But more and more I sort of think, and it's like, no, this is really what I think is important, right? So I don't think that we get very far by trying to deny what linguistics tells us or escape what psychology tells us about the importance of timing, for example, in cognitive processing. And so no matter sort of what comes in terms of developments in these incredible language model systems, I don't think that necessarily negates all the other insights of 50 years, if not centuries, of insight in linguistics and psychology. If anything, it sort of emphasizes or reiterates how important it is that we have a theory that can account for both types of information, so for structured information and statistics about it, right? And so far, that's really what I keep seeing is just being absent or not being there. So we kind of, as a field, polarize and go back and forth. So we say, okay, no, well, for a while, we focused a lot on symbolic structures and representations, while still, I think, not as much as we could have or not in the way that would have been most effective. And then, you know, there have been different sort of periods in the history of cognitive science and in language where you have a lot of focus on the importance of statistics and statistical learning. And I don't think one excludes the other by any means. And I'm just sort of hoping that more and more people come around to that point of view, because that's really the hard problem, is explaining both or understanding why both are important to the brain for processing language.
Okay, right. But so your interest is really in how the brain does it, how the mind does it, right?
Yeah. I don't know if I would make a distinction between the brain and mind, because I think that's also scary and difficult, but important. But yes, in both, I would say. If we want to be dualist about it, let's say both.
Yeah. Well, I just mean in contrast to, you know, the idea of multiple realizability, like if you can, like, can you, you know, maybe you can brute force this thing using just a statistical and associative approach.
Yeah.
And then structure comes along for the ride. Yeah. I mean, or do you disagree with that?
I would disagree with that, because I mean, I think it's going to be really hard to show that structure's there without sort of theoretical or like, you know, choices that you make to the instantiation, to the particular model that says, you know, here's what we think the ingredients of structure are. And there, I think there's a lot of stuff we could talk about in cognitive science about what those things might be. Waiting for them to emerge, I think, is kind of a weird approach. I mean, maybe it's possible. Mm. But is that really the approach that we want to take? And then if you sort of wait for structure to emerge from all the data and all the compute, then the question is, what are the right benchmarks or tests? And I feel like that's a huge can of worms, and that we can work on that and fight about it for decades. And I'm not really sure that that's as efficient as saying, I want to build these things already into the model. Then, of course, that begs the question, well, what are those things? And how do we agree on what is important? I think a lot of people do want to say, oh, yeah, no, the structure is emergent. It'll be there. But I feel like that's, you know, sometimes I wonder how do we evaluate that? Is that really, what is the science behind that? If that's the case, which I don't think it is, if it were the case, we still need to explain, how did that happen? And, you know, what does that tell us about the human organism?
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. So you said a lot there. I've seen multiple people saying that maybe, and we're not going to go down the large language model pathway quite yet, but just in terms of, you know, structure emerging from a purely statistical approach, well, you know, then there's always the question of meaning in the large language models. And multiple people I've had on the podcast have argued that, and others have argued that, well, maybe you can learn meaning later. So it's the opposite direction from the way that humans develop, right? Yeah. Where the meaning kind of comes along with the language, but maybe you can train up these large language models and that grounding isn't even necessary for meaning.
I mean, maybe. I wouldn't exclude that possibility, but that seems to me like an engineering question. I mean, the main thing that I think the models are missing that you need to get at meaning, all scary, scary topics, is intention. is intentionality, right? That's what these no system has, and we don't understand how humans have it. I mean, I think that we have it, and I don't want to dispute that at all, but how we have it is already, that's also a theoretical object worthy of study as well, right? So the fact that our representations are about things, that's the difference.
I mean, the reason I brought that up is just because of the structure / statistics question as well, of, you know, whether structure can come along later, and does it matter the order that these things are learned, and, you know, do we need to pay attention to how the human brain and mind develops?
I think it depends on your goal. I mean, I think we need to, because that's what I want to explain. That's what I want to study, is how the human mind and brain do something as interesting and powerful formally as language. But I think in terms of like the question, can you get a large language model to pass some benchmarks on meaning by first, you know, by adding stuff grounding later? Sure. Why not? I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, there's like infinite ways to cut a cake. There's infinite ways to arrive probably at the end behavior that we want. But is it following the path that we are? Now, I think that there's a bit of duality there. So you can say, you know, I think for a theory of how cognition or language arises in the human mind and brain, how it's learned or how it's implemented or how it came about. I think that you could... Some people, I want to sort of leave room for other other points of view. Some people might think that having something like, okay, this is the limit of what can be learned, whatever it is, we still, you know, that's also a subject of debate, from all of the data and from increasingly opaque training practices. You know, there's lots of leakage now, you know, a lot of, we can't really separate even between, maybe with GPT-4 it's a bit different, but with ChatGPT, the role of of reinforcement learning human feedback is likely quite large, right? Hmm. And we just don't, we don't know, you know. I mean, then I think we really have to turn to the open source large language models to study questions like that. But I don't see why in the limit that's going to tell me necessarily anything about how it works in the mind and brain. I will say, though, I have several analogies I've been using to like think about this for myself, but also to communicate it with other people. Is that, you know, in the history of science, right, the debate between geocentrism and heliocentrism, you could actually obtain better model fits, better prediction of the position of celestial bodies in their path with geocentric models, so models that posit that the Earth is at the center of our solar system. And that's because you can do that by adding more and more parameters that essentially overfit the data. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, we have to, in order to get the level of behavior that we expect now, we need to have more parameters than training data points, because we're really, you know, asking these systems to return things that humans are satisfied with, and basically through, I think, parameter interpolation, but not to verbatim reproduce the training data. And In order to do that, you're going to need this, you know, extreme parameter space.
We're going to come to your ambitious theoretical model eventually. But studying language is necessarily a human endeavor. Well, okay, that could be argued. But the vast majority of studying language is using humans, right? And another, I guess, advantage of not using humans or studying something that's not necessarily just a human cognitive function is being able to be more invasive in your experiments. So does the ability to acquire a limited range of data like EEG and fMRI, do you find that as a fundamental limiting aspect of your research? Or, well, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, although I see, like, I mean, feel like, you know, there's such, you know, the ethical reasons are solid. So, I mean, it is what it is, right?
Yeah.
I do feel it's a limitation. I'm not sure. I can't really imagine a world where we fully got around that. But I think it does certainly limit the rate at which we can map, you know, concepts in linguistics and cognitive science to concepts in neuroscience. Because, like, in my model, for example, I'm trying to think about things on a population coding level. Yeah. I just can't get data that are going to give me that resolution.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a large part of what you deal with is oscillations. And you can measure oscillatory measures using EEG and MEG. Mm-hmm. But then you're interested in the underlying neural population level, with gain modulation, inhibition. And so maybe we can just talk about your model.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, I guess one way to say that is, the readouts that we use are from MEG, and more I talk about them as neural dynamics because I want to sidestep the debate about, you know, pure oscillators and evoked responses, because I think, you know, spoiler, it's both. I don't want to get sort of sidetracked in trying to establish what, you know, again, a false dichotomy. So many things in our field are really a false dichotomy. It's really both, like, structure and statistics.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the evoked responses are really important, and sometimes I think they are endogenously generated. So there's state changes within that are driven internally, right? But that's what recognizing a word is from speech, or putting two words together. You're driving that state change internally. But for me, the important thing about neural dynamics or population rhythmic activity or oscillations is to remember what what ultimately their source is. In the limit, right? It's driven by neural ensembles. We might not understand the relationship to single unit activity, but single unit activity forming these different ensembles and synchronizing together. At some level, that is going to be reflected in what we can read off in our MEG signal. We just can't exclude different interpretations of it, and that is very limiting. But it doesn't mean that we should only theorize about the readout. It would be sort of like if I tried to come up with a theory in psycholinguistics that was about trying to explain reaction time differences for the sake of reaction time, and not trying to talk about the cognitive processes or the limits on eye movements of how eye movement control works, right? Not taking that into account. So for me, it's thinking of something, you know, trying to come up with a theory about, for example, syntactic structure building and oscillations that assumes any kind of one-to-one mapping between structure building and oscillation, as if an oscillation is a kind. It just doesn't really float for me. So I try to think, okay, I want to try to do this difficult abstract theoretical work. I'm first going to go to sort of this space where I know, given everything we know about the world, this is where the action has to be happening, even if I can't directly measure it myself. And then try to challenge myself as I develop the theoretical model and, you know, different instantiations of a specification in a computational model and different empirical projects. Try to see, okay, can the basic tenets, the first principles of this model, what would they look like when expressed on the other end, you know, in MEG neural dynamics, which I can't, you know, again, pin back one-to-one to a particular state of affairs intracranially or in on the population level. But still, I want them to be largely consistent with one another. Right. I don't think that it has the same explanatory force to come up with a theory of syntactic structure building that talks about the delta band or the theta band as divorced from the things that are actually producing those signals.
Mm-hmm. Well, so neural dynamics, I'm going to struggle to continue, because I just want to fall back on oscillations.
Just say oscillations. That's absolutely fine. We just go with the agreement between you and I that we're not but, trying to talk about pure oscillators.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing, is it puts such a different flavor onto it and makes it more agreeable. Because you can talk about dynamics is such a general term,
I know.
Right?
Yes.
And your model is, you know, talks about neural trajectories along a manifold.
Yes.
So that's dynamics as well.
Yes.
And you don't have to talk about oscillations per se in that regard.
Yeah,
but okay.
Right.
So, I was going to ask you, like, what the general, I know there's never a consensus in science, but what the current favorability within the language, cognitive sciences of language community of oscillations is, or neural dynamics, or you would you would answer them differently, right?
I would. So neural dynamics, I think, is actually, it includes more people and it includes more periods of time when, you know, like you can include event-related potential research in that, right? But on the other hand, I think the term should be flexibly used. But what I find, this is a bit meta response, but sometimes you can use certain terms and they can be very people can get completely the wrong idea about what you mean, or they react so strongly to that term that they don't listen anymore to what your argument is. And so I want to try to reach the most prepared listener or interested listener, not by sending people off already on, oh, but it can't be a pure oscillator, or it can't, you know.
Is rhythms not better?
I think rhythms is fine. I mean, it just depends. Like, I would say my laptop thing is shaking in. I think it depends on what your interest is. So I think if you're going to use the term oscillations, then you have to be, you know, careful about it, to be sort of neat. if you don't want to make that kind of commitment yet, because you don't have maybe all the information you need, like myself, then I fall back on terms like neural dynamics. But for me, I find I'm okay with all these terms. I don't find them
okay.
That they're making important theoretical distinctions at the moment.
Many moons ago, I had David Popol on the show, and he had some of the early work linking neural dynamics to phonemes and, you know, at the syllable level, and correlating different rhythms in EEG signal, for example, to the rhythms of the language.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious back to my question, just how the field writ large sees this kind of approach that you have, you know, continued, and we'll come back to your work as well.
I think there's like multiple layers here. So you've got people who are, like I've referenced before, the debate between, you know, is it an oscillation or not sort of camp, and that can be focused around speech and music processing, but it can also sort of be in all areas of neuroscience. Then sort of within sort of the oscillations and speech world, you have people who are really interested in speech processing, or in how oscillations might shape perception, psychophysics, who are sort of very focused on a different sort of level of explanation, I think. So I was recently at one of my favorite sort of workshops that gets together to talk about exactly these issues. And I was just sort of like, how can we not be talking about language when we talk about the brain's response to spoken language, right? I mean, that's really, I think, the behavioral goal. And I feel like it's the more low dimensional behavioral goal of the brain, right? People are trying to settle upon an interpretation of of the speech stimulus, right? And so that, mm-hmm. that's going to be linguistic in nature. If you know the language.
What's the alternative? Well, just talking about, go ahead.
No, but I don't think that people actually think deeply enough about this. So when you, I think there are interesting and important things to be explained in terms of speech processing, but that there might be a lot of, again, dynamics or signals that are going to sort of steer the brain that are more about more mesoscale objects like words or morphemes. Or intonation, or prosody, or turn taking. All these different kinds of things might actually be driving more of the brain's systems or the trajectory where you are at a given moment than per se reading out individual phonemes. Or if you want to talk about that, then you have to, you know, I think employ a different kind of close experimental technique where you're really manipulating things on a very fine grained level. Hmm. So I think the sort of world of oscillations in speech processing is really quite focused on understanding the theta rhythm, and they have a lot of focus on things like decoding, right? So you mm-hmm. you know, have segmentation. And when I see that literature, I feel like it's a very important and inspirational literature. But for me, the difference is I want to have sort of orthogonal evidence to instantiate a process. Like if I want to attribute, because you know, as you know, neural signals are so messy, right? There's so many things going on in the brain, and plus all the signal to noise problems. And then on top of that, I really want to have a strong motivation for saying, okay, this difference that I find, it's really about segmentation or decoding. I feel like that requires a lot of sort of theoretical pre-gaming and computational modeling, I think, or, you know, ways to develop more specific claims about what those operations might be before you can clearly attribute a neural readout patterns to one or the other explanation. But to return to your question about the sort of the status of the field, if I had to sort of like summarize it in a high level way, you've got the focus really on speech processing and oscillations, and then there's a smaller but enthusiastic group of people working on what would have been called sentence processing a few years ago in oscillations, and this actually has roots even decades ago when people started looking in the time frequency domain, mostly with EEG, and looking at basically power modulations. And now this has sort of had a resurgence where we try to, you know, we do have different techniques to look at the relationship between power and phase of different bands and different linguistic annotations. And within that camp, there seems to be some people who are more focused on how much can be explained by having sort of a one-to-one mapping either between syntactic structure or prosody or surprisal and neural oscillations or modulations of them, and then I guess that would be sort of the main approach, and I sort of don't really fall into any of that.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your model then, because as you were describing the way that the field currently sees this, it made me think of your model, and so you posit. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects to your model, but it all kind of begins with an internal predictive sort of model about mm-hmm. what is coming speech-wise, right?
Yes.
And that is like shaping the incoming sensory information.
That's right.
And pushing it along a manifold.
That's right. Yes.
So in that sense, and so maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on your model, but I'll seed it with this question. Like in that sense, are the like theta, are the rhythms sort of a readout of that shaping process, yes. would you say?
Yes, okay. I would. Thank you. It means so much to me that you got that. Oh. That's wonderful. Thank you. Yes. yes, that's exactly right. So when I was working on this model, I really wanted to challenge myself to try to capture just the minimal, you know, things I couldn't give up about language with what I felt was a very sort of, you know, abstract, low dimensional, and you could argue it's high dimensional, but a sort of, you know, manifold approaches in neuroscience that are only becoming more popular, but were sort of burgeoning a few years ago. And I took a lot of, you know, really dove into that to try to say, can I really make these things, you know, maybe they can't ever meet in a one-to-one way. Like I've talked about, I don't think there could be this one-to-one mapping, but at least how much do I have to break concepts in both fields to try to then fuse them together? It asks a lot of readers, so I you know that they have to sort of be willing to dive into both domains. But for me, that was the goal, because I was no longer sort of satisfied with coming up with, you know, box model-like theories that just didn't have anything to say about the neural readouts that we were measuring. Mm. And I didn't want to work on trying to understand these neural readouts and giving up, you know, sort of my object of study or the lessons of linguistics and cognitive science. So that was my response to that problem.
Well, can you, maybe in your own words, can you describe your model? Like the
I thought you did a great job.
Oh, okay. Well,
No, so basically what I wanted to capture with this model was really the idea that you have this unfolding trajectory where you can get a lot of the information that typically would have been thought about in more traditional psycholinguistics or cognitive science models as being sort of separate, right? So even I don't in no way deny the fact that syntax and semantics can be described orthogonally, right? So you can have separate formal linguistic fields and tools and methods for describing the systematicity of those information sources in language. But I think to the brain, even though it might, the brain, I believe that we and the brain knows rules that are formally dissociable, I think the actual representation of that information in real time and processing probably does not best serve the brain by being distinct. And so one way to bring that together is to think in a manifold space where you have populations that might be able to decompose the source of information like syntax and semantics on different dimensions. But it's really the patterns of activity that they that you can project into that manifold space that are going to capture that information for language, right? So it's kind of a way of having your cake and eating it too. So you don't deny that you can separate these sources of information formally, but you have a way of expressing them in neural population activity that where they impinge upon each other, right? Where you have to plot one in relation to the other, and that's the key.
So the manifolds are nested, much as the structure of language?
Yes, although again, I don't want to say that that's a one-to-one relationship in the structure, although I tried to say that they're not injective in the paper. But I think that, you know, discovering exactly how they're nested and how much how they map onto each other, you know, how much the different levels affect each other and how that's expressed in the space-time of the brain, like where in the brain and when, I think that's all up, obviously up for debate. This is more a theoretical exercise. You know, is this possible? What would this look like? Mm. And just last month, I managed someone who was actually starting to work on manifolds and speech processing, and I thought this is really, really cool. I mean, I'm hoping that they're going to solve all the really hard bottom up problems making manifolds of speech processing in brain, and then I can come back, you know, in 10 years and be like, oh, let me see if I can test my models on yours.
Well, I mentioned it's a theoretical model, but
yeah.
So how's it coming along? Where are you in the process of, you know, implementing?
Yeah, so there are various, you know, sort of various offshoots. I'm not sure that I gave like, you know, all of the best description of everything that the model claims, but that can come out as I keep talking. But so what I've been trying to do is sort of the core claim, right, is that you're going to get relational structures, sort of the proto ingredients of something like a word or a syntactic structure by looking at the dynamics between populations, right? This is how you can also preserve information. You can bind words together in models like DORA, Discovery of Relations by Analogy. That's Alex Dumas's model, and he's a good friend and collaborator of mine, and we've worked on this question together in the computational modeling space. Mm-hmm. And then so my theoretical model sort of takes that as a core principle. So you've got this time-based binding, so you've got the neural dynamics that are giving you these relational structures. And then the question is, you know, what are the sort of broad strokes predictions of that that we can measure, that we don't need to have, you know, data we can't get in order to validate or not? And that a couple of students in my group have been working on projects that look at that. So basically the sort of most coarse-grained claim is that there's going to be more phase synchronization the more structure that you build. So the more that you have to coordinate these distributed populations together in order to establish relationships between them, the more they're going to be synchronized. That's like a very, you know, broad strokes.
But might there be like a limit or a ceiling, right, of synchronization?
Probably. Important thing. So one of the things that comes back again, and so what's the right baseline? So what is sort of, you know, the base rate of synchronization in the language mm-hmm. network or in the brain in a given time or when you're listening to stories or when you're in resting state? So establishing that's really important. We're not totally there yet. But looking sort of within experiment condition contrast, so between phrases and sentences, for example, when we've meticulously made them the same length in time, physically indistinguishable. this is the work of Fan Bai, a recent PhD student graduate in my group, that we can show that when you make these stimuli so that they really are physically as similar as possible in the same amount of time, we can still detect a difference in synchronization and different measures related to synchronization in EEG between whether something is a phrase or a sentence. And this is possible in Dutch because we can make phrases and sentences the same number of syllables.
So going back to the, you know, just thinking about manifolds again, I mean, is there a, I'm thinking of these kind of nested manifolds and the phase synchronization, helping them communicate between each other. Is there like an upper limit to, or maybe I should say lower limit, like the lower limit to the dimensionality, right? As, you know, because we think of manifolds as like a lower dimensional structure, lower dimensional from the, let's say you have a million neurons, right?
Yeah.
Well, that would be a million dimensional space.
Yes.
That then gets lowered, right? And I relate the dimensionality to the abstraction of like a concept or meaning.
Yes.
So where is the bottom?
Yeah, that's a good question. I hadn't thought about the absolute, you know, what is the absolute bottom? I always think, you know, the important thing to remember with the manifolds that I talk about in my model is that, you know, they're defined over a given time period and, you know, a moment in the brain, so to speak, or the data set that you have. So I don't know if you mean sort of like the bottom for all representational states or for a given.
Well, I'm just thinking about intelligence and, creating concepts and understanding, you know, the meaning of a concept, for example, or the meaning of a story.
Maybe this is a way to approach the question. So I was talking actually to Alex Dumas, my friend and collaborator, about this. So, you know, just because we think that neural dynamics are important for representing structured, relational, symbolic information, that doesn't exclude the fact that, for example, single units can learn or encode, you know, conjunctive codes, or that you have a localist node or a localist code, which is different from conjunctive coding, that would encode some kind of, you know, necessary ingredient for a relation or a particular binding, a particular relationship between a value and a variable. So probably the system is going to use both, right? So, you know, the famous grandmother cell and things like this. I don't think that the existence of cells like that, you know, the debates, I don't think that the existence of those, whether that's, you know, real or not, necessarily says that neural dynamics aren't important. I think that neural dynamics being important for symbolic representation doesn't exclude the fact that you have cells that encode this, right? So I think it's a sparse and redundant system.
Yeah. Well, I'm not thinking so much in terms of neurons, and I apologize because I think my question is ill-formed.
Okay.
But I think the issue is I'm trying to picture these like state spaces.
Yes.
And their relation to each other.
Right.
Within language, right? And I want to like, so then I necessarily, for myself, because I'm not that bright, I'm trying to like see the kind of like the shapes and how they relate to each other.
Yeah.
And then where's the end of it, right? Where's the...
So I was trying to think about what you might mean with your question, that it could be like, what's the... Sorry.
Make it a better question.
So, no, it's on my end. I just don't understand the question. No, that the sort of... You know, maybe one way to think about it is what the system tries to do, again, because with these manifolds, you can do perceptual inference, right? That's another big part of my model.
Yeah, talk about that for a moment. Yeah. Because
So you want to sort of basically leap, you know, as much evidence as you have, you want to take it as far as you can. And you want to leverage your knowledge about the hierarchical structure of language and your language experience. You want to leverage both of those things, right? So, you know, we know that we have exquisite sensitivity even to, you know, speaker adaptation. So talking to each other can change our vowel spaces. And I think that, you know, we obviously want to use that information as much as we can, but we don't want to, you know, be taken over by statistics such that we end up in the wrong interpretation or not what's being said, right? Because, you know, in an extreme situation is if we really were only just predicting the most predictable thing, we would only hear that thing, right? We wouldn't hear what was actually said because people don't always say the most predictable thing. In fact, that's often how we get important new information. So I guess the sort of the lower limit on conceptual representation, if we're not going to talk about single neurons, then I would say is, okay, when you have something that you really can't associatively or structurally or relationally relate to anything else, you know, I guess then you've got a predicate without an argument or a...
But my internal model would fill that in.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. No, I mean, maybe learning new sensory learning or perceptual learning situations, I think, is like learning that mapping of some sensory stimulus to, you know, your internal model. And I guess my model would claim that that internal model is so biasing that it's always going to be warping that sensory stimulus towards its state.
That happens as we get older, right?
Yeah,
we don't listen to what people are actually saying. We listen to what we hear them for ourselves and our own internal model.
Yeah.
Okay, going back to your model, and the original question there, kind of how far along you are with like the different aspects of the model.
Right, that's right, yes. Yeah, so like I was saying, so these findings, so we keep finding, you know, again, the important that when language comprehension is happening, we compare it to a bunch of, you know, carefully thought out controls. We see again, you know, this synchronization is really important, and also readouts that are related to synchronization. So coupling of various varieties. And through that, we're then trying to make, you know, more detailed sort of movies of activation in time to spoken language comprehension. And then the rub becomes trying to understand those neural dynamics projected in space. So how do we constrain that in the right space? That's a whole another issue with human brain imaging. And I've been working on, you know, starting to work on that in collaboration with others, trying to situate these, you know, dynamic signals in a space is a lot. Beyond that, right, you then want to understand how much of that signal and the dynamics of it is just pushing a signal through a distributed network. So when you can understand what's being said to you, you know, you're presumably recruiting lots and lots of distributed networks, more so than if you can't understand it, right? So even just that difference is probably going to be important for understanding, for example, delta modulations in language. But that's sort of the empirical trajectory. We're trying to also get a better understanding of what's the right kind of annotation. So a lot of the annotations that we use to decompose our neural readouts are things like, the syntactic structure is annotated in a story, an audiobook story, word onsets. We can also use a lot of natural language processing tools to get things like phoneme entropy, word entropy, surprisal, such and such, and use them to see, you know, as we build these more specified or articulated models, how much more of the data is that explained, and that's all well and good. But lately, more in my thinking, I mean, there are many people in the group working on that, and it's very important. But I think we're all sort of coming to the conclusion together. We need to sort of break or rethink how we think about expressing linguistic representation in our annotations. And so that's probably going to come through a combination of more data-driven decomposition of the neural readout, and that's something that actually machine learning and deep learning can help with.
Oh, yeah, but that, using it as a tool.
Yes, as a statistical model, right? It's a way to decompose.
Sorry,
signals.
I just want to clarify what that means, rethinking how the annotations are represented.
Yeah, so more and more we're sort of questioning, like I said before, where I think that sometimes it doesn't necessarily serve us to think about how syntax and semantics might be orthogonal, even though they are. You know, I don't take away from any of their legitimacy as separate systems. I think the brain might have to do something more interesting to combine them together or be constrained by them in real time. Now, how would that actually work? So the way that we do it now in our analysis is we annotate things, and we, by the way, don't have any good semantic annotations, really. That's another thing that we're thinking about and working on, right? So the best thing that people tend to have are things like word embeddings or vector embeddings. But that has a lot
in the state space, and that's how you gather their meaning.
Yeah, and that does okay, but that has a lot of assumptions in it that don't necessarily have to be the case. So we're also trying to explore, you know, what are the assumptions, are they going in the direction that we want or not there? But my point is there that already in the annotations are some of our is a specification or a bunch of our assumptions about how it works, and I think that you know, we need that right now because we understand so little of the neural readout, and it's really gotten us a foot in the door, and you know. But I think we need to also at the same time push ourselves to think like, well, how can we change how we think about this representationally without denying any of the system facts, but not really biasing the view of what we see or putting blinders on because we want to annotate our stimulus in this particular way because that's the way we've always done it.
But is this a job for linguistics?
It is a job for linguistics. It's where we need linguists, indeed.
But the annotation has been set by linguistics.
It has,
linguists
but,
in the past, so
yes.
they might be upset if you come back and say, "Hey, we need you to do this different."
I mean, I think it's something where we work together, right? Where we say, like, look, this is the property of your formal analysis that we want to capture. But when we do it this way, we have a certain assumption about how that relates to the neural time series data that we don't think is necessarily anything to do with your theory, right? It's just a part of how the annotation works. What do you think about that? And then we can, it's not easy or fast work, but it's important because I think it creates another space where different expertises come together to try to, what is the essence of what we want to capture with models, right? And annotations are in a sense, a model, right?
So this would be using an argument from dynamics, from time, to nudge a linguist to think more in terms of how time would constrain
and
the
there
structure?
Are, I want to make, there are examples of that out there already. So there are people who have worked and thought about that. But it's more thinking about then how do you, at the end of the day, how do you get a matrix that then you relate to another matrix?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
And you don't want to just use matrix multiplication. So.
Yeah. Okay. It's the go-to. Yeah. It was interesting. I'd never thought about annotations in semantics. I mean, the story is it's all in a state space, an embedded vector in a state space. But have you guys come up with other potential?
There are some students in the group working on it. It's a hard problem. And I think there's a reason it doesn't exist at this point. Yeah. But it's more, we're focusing more on, and this is also inspired by the work of many, many people, that it's, the sort of transition moments when you have a change of state or something happens in the semantic world, not just the distributional representation of a word in a corpus. It's something that's actually unfolding in that particular phrase, sentence, or discourse that's important. And some other, there are many ways that this has been reflected to some degree in existing things, so situation models, discourse models, but coming up with, annotations that could reflect sort of the crucial insight of each traditional level of linguistic analysis, I think, is important. Not everything is going to stick, right? It's not clear to me, what is the limit of this? What is the end? When do you stop adding features or predictors? It's not, you can't, I don't think you can play 20 questions with features or model predictors and win either. But I think it is at least important. It is striking, nonetheless, that we don't seem to have a sort of standing go-to temporally situated semantic annotation.
Yeah, well, time is so important for biological systems, right?
Yes.
I mean, well,
yes.
I didn't mean that as a question, right?
I have not read this book, but I have it on my desk because that important.
Okay, cool. I'll have to look that up. The Geometry of Biological Time.
I know. You want to be talking about being scared.
Oh, that's going to be all about topology spaces.
Yeah, that's the other thing. So yeah, then it becomes all about topology and that has lots of assumptions that I'm not totally sure are right for this problem. But anyway.
Well, you have to wear a lot of hats, right? That's the other thing about language, because you have to understand the linguistic structure. Or you don't have to, but I think it's wise to, right?
Yes.
But I guess linguists. So I'm gonna come back to artificial systems here in a second.
Okay.
But the first thing I wanted to ask you about then, linguists have traditionally discarded time because it's of no importance when you're looking at. Or that's a question.
No, that's right. So I mean, let's return to the great David Marr and say, they're working on the computational level. So they have a computational level theory of what needs to be explained. And that does not have to have any bearing on time.
Well, that's a question. Is that true?
For the brain, I don't think it's true. So that's sort of more and more what my models are ending up being is
but that's
this,
the implementation level, even for the well, computational
but,
level.
Yeah, but that you get that all of the levels actually end up constraining each other in practice.
Right.
So it's sort of like the spherical cow situation. Yes, there is value in having theories on those different levels that are divorced from each other. But for me, and trying to go after the question that I'm going, I see more and more how the levels have to influence each other. They have to constrain each other. And time is one that can constrain all of them. And yes, how that impinges on the computational level, I think, is probably the most fraught.
Well, so going back to the importance of time, it's everything. Between our communication, yours and mine. I've often just kind of in my mind wanderings, thinking about consciousness and being, and thinking, well, maybe the Earth, maybe geological time is just on a different scale. We don't have to bring like awareness into this, but it's still a time scale. But then something like a Turing machine or a large language model or any computational model, you just can turn it off one day and then and it's frozen, essentially. And time is not of the essence in a Turing machine, for example, because there's no necessity for it. So is that just a biological constraint, or do we really think that like there's something that temporal, that, like, are dynamics important for cognition?
I mean, I think this is a very deep philosophical and metaphysical question. But I think that we're sort of dealing again on sort of the mesoscale, right? So for our brains and our behavior, time is really, really important. And if you want to talk about, you know, what is time, of course, it's a deep question beyond the scope of my expertise, but minimally, it has a relational quality, right? So there's some relative nature to it, right? Mm-hmm. That one thing happened before another, or the path back from one state to another is not accessible. And I think not taking that into account would definitely hamper our understanding of how information processing works. And what neural time series data can represent or do represent.
So in that regard, I guess like a large language model does have some ordering somehow, although it looks at everything all at once in one kind of computational step. So, but there is a relational aspect.
Right, but that relational aspect is fundamentally driven by what the goal of the system is. Like, so relational in accordance to what, right? So if you don't have there's sort of no impetus or bias or reason to, or I could say the motivation or the bias or the impetus to have hierarchical structure is not as strong for predicting the next word, if that's your only task in life, as it is for clearly for the tasks that humans are solving with language, right? Or mm-hmm. that language, I hesitate to use the word evolved because it's so fraught, but that language appeared over time to solve.
Neural dynamics instead of oscillations appeared instead of evolved.
No. We could have several of these interviews about all these other topics, some of which I'm not an expert on. And I'm trying to avoid that. I want to give you the answers though to your questions in a timely fashion. I think evolution has there's a lot of assumptions about it that might hold for biological systems where the link to language has to be better fleshed out and more carefully contemplated, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, that's
again,
fair.
Not an expert.
Yeah. I guess my question really is just about, like, maybe I'm repeating myself, but how important is like the temporal aspect to cognition? Is it just a biological constraint? Or is there, are there so many different ways to skin a cat that we will eventually, these large language models, even if they work on a completely different principle, mm-hmm. will, without having any time constraint, mm-hmm. Right? And there's doesn't need to be a manifold. Doesn't need to be.
So one way to think about this is, right, so like I said before, you know, there are infinite ways to cut a cake. I was, again, trying to avoid the skin the cat expression, but okay, there's infinite ways to skin a cat.
Neural dynamics, evolution, and cut a cake.
No evolution, appeared. Emergence. Sorry. Yes. Also bad. Trying to not step in all of the minefields in one step.
I need to change that language myself. Yeah, so the cat language.
Anyway, okay, so the point is what I'm talking about. So so with large language models, maybe what they have in common with the brain, and I don't know, for me, this is not a deep insight, but you know, maybe for others it is that, you know, there's an unfolding time series. And in some way, the language model is, you know, by having access to everything all at once, but to having this sort of, you know, there are different aspects of the architecture, but also the mapping of the training procedure and everything that do force that kind of, you know, sequentialization of information processing, mm-hmm. that is not in common with how speech input comes into the brain at some level, right? But like we were talking about before with time, you know, I think there's a lot of people also thinking about this notion of brain time, right? That part of the reason that we have cognition, or way that we abstract away from sensory and perceptual representations, is to get away from the vagaries of time, to be able to do more with that information than just have it be a sort of echoic perceptual thing that's then gone. If we can have memory and we can bootstrap that and leverage all the other things we can do with those representations once they've been taken away from their temporal extension, we can do a lot more with that information.
But in the brain and in your proposed model, there's still, so oscillations have a lot to do with the computational aspect, right? So they're in some sense, an implementation, although we just, before we're talking about how they're more of a readout, maybe you can clear this up for me more.
Yeah.
How do you see oscillations in the rule?
Yeah. No, it's again one of these things where one characterization does not exclude the other. And I guess this is like coming back again and again for me, is that like every time one is presented with something that seems like it's mutually exclusive or a paradox, if you do a little bit of digging, you quickly find that it's not. Yeah. So I think that it's definitely the case that, when we talk about oscillations, that they can be a readout, right, of a computation that you could describe on the population level, right? So we do it in the sort of most neutral terms. Certainly you could use the oscillations as a way of talking about the computations on the population level that, as we talked about before, for humans we can't access. But you can still imagine a world where sometimes, you know, the computation that's embodied in a particular population, it's going on and it gets hit by a traveling wave of, you know, information that is going to change the sort of however you want to talk about it, the LFP, the base rate, whatever potentiation of that, part of that microcircuit or even on a larger level. And then is it part of the computation or not? Yes. But also not no in the sense of that, you know, and then you're saying, okay, it was like, in the Bourjaki term of neural syntax, that you're reading something out on the other, you know, that you have a reader that sort of catches the information processing of the last circuit or whatever, right? So you're not in that direct link-up situation anymore, but you can have your computation still be affected by it. So I think sometimes it helps to deconstruct a bit what we mean when we say, okay, are they doing computations or not? Is there actually a world where they're only doing computation where they're purely epiphenomenal? And often the answer is always in between, right?
Yeah.
So same thing with the invoked induced question, right? So, you know, clearly there's going to be evoked information that's important. And clearly the role of oscillations or something that happens to oscillations is they get combined with evoked responses, because we can talk about, it is still important to talk about specialization and encapsulation and maybe to some degree modularity. Modularity is also one of those words for me. but I think we also can't pretend like everything is, you know, independent or not, you know, connected spatially next to each other, part of the same organ.
I mean, it's amazing thinking that we can think, knowing that we can think at all, given, you know, there's the circular causality aspect also, because part of the computation becomes part of the readout of the computation.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But maybe that's a feature, not a bug, right? It's only from our perspective as the measurement person, the experimenter or the modeler, that we make this distinction. I think that's another important thing to always remember with modeling. That distinction between readout and computation might only be true at that particular instance from our point of view, from the brain's point of view, or depending where you are in the brain or what circuit or computation you're interested in, those answers can change.
So where am I left then thinking about building models of language? Like, should I, are we forever going to be coming up short? Because, I mean, a model is always wrong, right?
Yes.
All models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yes, exactly. For me, I think, you know, this is also something that I think about a lot with my friend and collaborator, Olivia Guest, where we talk about, you know, what can models tell us, and how do models adjudicate between theory and data? And that the data are always right, and that's not to be a data chauvinist. It's just to be actually a proponent of theory building. That we need to the theories always need to be better, and what better actually means is complicated and depends on sort of your goal and the task at hand, right? But lost my train of thought.
You're alluding to a couple papers. The most recent was 2023 this year, that is really specific about how to differentiate between levels, right? Theoretical levels, specification levels, implementation, different aspects of
how to
figure something out.
Sorry, before we get to this, can I just interrupt you? Because I want to get back to, because you asked, now I remember what you were asking me. Where are we with building language models in the brain, and how frustrating is that? While you were talking, I was thinking about, it helps to talk about what I worry about with the manifold approach is really like, when we want to think about capturing a formal system like language in a neural manifold. And this is, these are ideas and things I've worried about together with several people in my group, Cass Copemans, Kartikeya Kaushik, and also with Alex Dumas. That, you know, how can you, if we want to give a space to something like language, then we're taking this, you know, this infinite means and putting it in a finite space. And isn't that problematic? And then we started to think about this more and more. And basically, I wanted to do this proof that we haven't gotten around to yet, to trying to think about whether, you know, the space of ungrammatical things is more infinite or a bigger infinity than the space of grammatical utterances, and then and to understand the relationship of those infinite sets in relationship to the sets of what could be expressed with neural dynamics in various manifold spaces. Oh. And I don't know the answer to that. But that seems to me to be a clear, again, I think a lot about boundaries. If it's the case, right, that the orders of magnitude of infinity in those spaces are not reconcilable, then we have a problem, right? So that's for my own brand of language modeling. I can answer the question in response to large language models as well, if that's
no. Let's stick on your own branding of modeling. So what's your hunch to the answer?
My hunch is that time, again, this time and space. So I don't know. I don't have a very strong intuition about the infinity of trajectories in different spaces and how they can, depending on that, of course, hinges completely on how they're defined, right? Mm-hmm. But time is a really important aspect for approaching limits in those spaces. But my intuition about the grammatical versus ungrammatical structure thing is more sharp, and that is that the space of ungrammatical strings or utterances is going to be larger than grammatical ones, because even within, you know, this is a lot of interesting formal work exists in linguistics, you can really show that sort of the space of, in the formal space, human languages still occupy a particular corner of that space. They're not actually really that spanning the space of formal systems. And I think that's actually important, and that can tell us something about the neural implementation of these kinds of formal systems.
Because it's like a limiting?
Yes. Because I can at least say, okay, if we can understand why those limits are there in that space, can we then understand the analog in the neural manifold space? Again, that gets trippy really fast, but it's at least a foot in the door. You know, it's a way to tack down one part of the map to the other map, and then to the territory. Because otherwise, it just, you know, everything, if you're no longer pointing at each other in a meaningful way, I think. So that's at least in our space. So trying to sharpen the computational claims of how a neural manifold could lead to functionally linguistic representations is one avenue. Trying to look in neural time series data and neural dynamics to really understand if the broad strokes predictions of the model about synchronization and coupling are borne out in a basic way. And then trying to, you know, tease apart or break the ways we think about annotations and form linguistic representation to sort of brain them. How much can we warp them or smooth them or change them to become more integratable with our neural dynamics?
Is part of the, so you mentioned earlier, the problem is you have an infinite potential of grammatical structures. And then the one that we occupy in that state space, we're in a very small corner.
So slightly different there. So there's two important aspects here. One is that that any language has this, you know, infinite productivity, basically through recursion. We can keep adding stuff forever. Nobody does that because nobody lives forever, unfortunately. So that is a limit on a proof. But the other observation is that the way that human languages work, they still only occupy one particular corner of the space of possible formal languages, the way the formal languages could work, which we see in computing or mathematics, right? But I think that fact can be capitalized upon more than we currently do in understanding, you know, that state space and trying to relate it to neural dynamics in some meaning. Not in a one-to-one way. Again, that's almost never the right approach. But what are the constraints on that space? What are the constraints on the neural manifold space of expressive trajectories, right? And then can we begin in that way to gradually link things together such that we have a principled way to decide what are the kind of annotations that we should relate to our neural data?
Yeah. Okay. But what is the dimensionality of language?
Oh, it depends on who you ask.
Sorry. Is dimensionality really one of those words for you?
No. Do we need dimensionality is a safe word. It's a good word. dimensionality reduction.
Well, the reason, right. So a manifold is a reduced dimensionality space. And then if we're like comfortable with language on a manifold, it sounds dumber.
Yeah, no, but I don't want to go into tractability is also maybe a bit, but it's more studyable for us.
Yeah.
And okay. I think, what I said, if we think that, yes, it's not to say that there aren't neural signals that are tapping into all these different dimensions of language and of perceptual experience. It's just, what are the, you know, what's the PCA of them? What is the thing that's really, that we can attribute most of the trajectory to? And as much as that's at least signal strength. Now, that doesn't in any way mean that other information is not encoded or important to the brain. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then we start being limited by how we can relate our models to the data, I think.
Okay. Should we go back to talking about just how you approach all these? I mean, there are just so many issues. And recently you've written with Olivia Guest, kind of formalizing an approach.
Let's go back to that, yeah.
Did you take on that project because just there are so many thorny issues for language specifically, or is this just a cognitive modeling?
It was really like, you know, we were working together and we had such a great time writing the first modeling paper and really, you know, really coalesced some of the things that she and I think about in our own research programs, which are actually very different. But we think a lot in the same ways. We have a lot of the same sort of reactions to things. And we really had a catalyzed way of thinking about modeling together. And it was just so much fun. And I really felt that we were, so many things that we've been thinking about really came together. And that was a natural extension to that was then thinking about that for computational cognitive neuroscience. And also the more and more we saw the sort of pattern of reasoning in the field where we think, you know, is that really what people want to claim? Is that really like what do we take away from that? That's not totally internally consistent. And then we started to analyze it more and think about it more deeply. And then this sort of, you know, it all started actually from a tweet thread of some observations and frustrations that I had. And then Olivia came in and worked as a postdoc for a year in my group before moving on to an assistant professorship in AI here at the university. And that one year, we just got so into this paper and banged out. And there's so many things that would continue from that and thinking about these problems.
What were the frustrations that you had you felt compelled to tweet about?
Yeah, always a mistake, right? Never work out your emotions on social media. In this case, it had a good outcome. But it's more that I see more and more, and I don't want to like make it personal or anything, because I hold us all accountable. I think it's really a sort of zeitgeist or a way of thinking that we all are complicit in, is that, you know, when you fit a model to the data and you get a good fit, you know, you don't conclude that the model then is the object that you're modeling. And that seemed to just start, this sort of, it's happening more and more. And maybe it's particular with language, but I've also seen it in vision, to be honest. And I'm really still very interested in exploring what does that mean for people? And this is sort of a meta science question. Like when you say, okay, this model, because it's very different from the sort of way that we learned cognitive modeling, the both of us in the 90s and noughties. It's just a different approach, right? Where you start to really sort of, things start to bleed together in a way that I just never, as a modeler, never considered.
Elaborate on that. What do you mean they bleed together?
Well, I think it's more sort of like the map and the territory. So, this is the properties of the map that is your model of the territory, they don't extend to the territory itself. So I think, you know, in our paper, we have some great example with a digital clock, right? I don't know if you remember this figure.
I was trying to pull up the paper just because I wanted to get the different levels right. So this is the 2016 one?
For my model or for the work? For the
oh,
work
sorry,
the,
no, the 2023.
That's the paper with Olivia about logical inference. And
yeah, but that doesn't have the one that has the...
Oh, that's the one from 2021. You mean the...
2021.
The modeling with a theory, specification, and
yeah, okay, yeah, but we can talk about... Model. So the 2023 one is complex.
It is. So, it is.
remind us of the clock.
The clock... Yeah, I have a slide of it here. I don't know if it's helpful to share that.
Well,
or not.
The vast majority of the audience is audio.
Listening. Okay, yeah. So I'll try my best to describe it. So the whole paper is sort of based around what we see as this fallacy in reasoning not necessarily directly in the empirical work. So we're not making a claim about, you know, the work that people are doing is inductive reasoning. So we're not trying to apply deductive rules to it. But what we're saying more is when you create a meta-theoretical calculus about that formalizes how models relate to theories and data, that these kind of fallacies seem to pop up. And you see them again and again. We have this whole, you know, sort of database of occurrences. So when you're thinking about a digital clock, an analog clock or a clockwork clock as an analogy to, for example, large language models and the human brain or something, right? So Digital clocks display the time, clockwork clocks display the time and require manual winding. Therefore, digital clocks require manual winding, right? So that's clearly a fallacy. We see it easily when we talk about digital clocks and clockwork clocks. But when we talk about large language models in the brain, somehow this eludes us. Somehow there's this strong urge to give the attributes of the map to the territory. So then we can translate this. So we do this. So artificial neural networks correlate with fMRI data. Brains correlate with fMRI data and instantiate the biological mechanisms for cognition. Therefore, artificial neural networks instantiate the biological mechanisms for cognition.
So is this in response to like the recent work that compares the predictive responses in brain activity to the predictive, correlates that to the predictive aspects in large language models?
I think it's actually a tradition that's been going on for quite some time. No, so then we've made a version of the syllogism that makes it more specific. Okay. So artificial neural networks produce grammatical strings. You can say large language models produce grammatical strings. Humans produce grammatical strings and instantiate the biological mechanisms for language. Therefore, large language models instantiate the biological mechanisms for language. Not going to be the case, right?
Not necessarily. It could be the case.
No, it could be the case, but not necessarily. That's
a logical fallacy to assume it is the case.
Yes, and the other point is that we talk about this in the paper, is there's so many things that would disqualify these models as being models of cognition. And or of language, but we don't worry about that fact so much, right?
Can you list some of those?
Well, the parameters, the training procedures, the data. The complete lack of internal structure that has any interpretable mapping to cognitive theory, and that's all changeable, right? That could be changed. It doesn't necessarily have to be the case. But something, just to say briefly about it. Because again, this is not my focus, is that, as you see, as the performance becomes more and more important, the predictive quality for the brain is also going down, right? So that's something that many people have noticed. So at the end of the day, I don't really know, I think about this a lot because it's so common, right? People really believe that there is something behind it. And I want to understand what that is, because what would be, so I try to ask myself, what would it mean if we take that key claim to its limit. And I wrote some notes for myself about this because I was really trying to think about it. And I guess, some of the things that...
The key claim being that large language models are useful as... So
they're different claims. So I think the most extreme version is large language models are the brain, which I think everyone would say, no, I don't mean that. Okay. Yeah. But I think another version of that is that, they're a good model or a good enough model of language in the brain or of cognition in the brain, right? So I think that's fine.
Okay.
And then we can talk about what's a valuable model. I think it's all very complicated and worth thinking about. But,
But what's the key though? The key claim that you mentioned is the good enough version?
Yeah, or the people that, what typically seems to happen, and this is what this paper with Olivia that we focus on, is you find that an artificial neural network or a large language model can predict neural activity. And then what do you conclude from that?
Therefore,
and there's all this range of conclusions I guess maybe a good summary of the sort of middle of the road one is then these models are good models of, condition X, task Y, capacity Z in the brain. Fine. Okay. Let's go with that. So then when I was thinking about this, so the price of modeling or the power of modeling is that you sort of exchange, you exchange specificity or you simplify and leave out stuff and gloss over things in order to gain insight into the shared causal structures of the mechanisms between your model and the object of modeling or the phenomenon in the world, right? But in some way, when we do this, if we say that, substituting models of cognition or theories of cognition and language with large language models is good enough, or if we base our theories on them, in some level, I think we're saying that predicting signals is more important than explaining them. And I think we have to think about if that's what we really mean and what are the implications of that. Maybe people disagree with that. Maybe that's not what they mean when they say that. Then I want to know more what is it? What is meant by that? What is the good model? Is it it's a good model because it predicts? It's a good model because it behaves a certain way. That's the other thing. So in some level, I think we're saying that behavior is enough. So approximating, function approximation is enough. And that seems like an engineering goal to me.
But I think even some neuroscientists would be, well, neuroscientists concerned with behavior would be okay with that.
Yeah.
If the answer is like, what is cognition, not what is biological cognition?
Yeah. No, right. I think this touches quickly and deeply back onto, you know, debates about computationalism and cognitive science, representationalism. Yeah. And again, I think it's both. So why can't dynamical systems represent and compute? It's a choice for us to believe that they cannot. It's a choice for us to not to try to, you know, bend or break or reformulate how we talk about these systems, both formally and conceptually, in order to do that. And that's what I think. It's the same with structure and statistics. Face the hard problem. Are they really mutually exclusive? Does one really mean we can't do the other?
We're so much more comfortable thinking and talking in dichotomies. And that is that a roadblock?
Dichotomous thinking? On some level, I don't know. I just had the insight. I thought, maybe that's actually like a fundamental part of cognition and perception in general, is trying to give a deterministic perceptual interpretation to a probabilistic series of cues, right?
But all from a probabilistic brain. The probabilistic brain is...
Yeah. But then that's that same tension between structure and statistics and between dichotomies and gradients and whatever. You know, you can create a gradient between anything, right? Is again that tension. So you've got, you know, this probabilistic cues but for the sake of behavior and for... You know, I guess at some level it's about practicality. Determinism enters into the processing stream at some point, right?
Mm-hmm. And categorizing things is also one of the things we do well that has served us well, right? So concepts, making concepts. And
indeed.
So orthogonalizing everything to its maximal degree.
That's right. And I think that clearly has a huge benefit, right, in terms of structuring the world, right, creating an internal structured model. But it has negative sides too. Mm-hmm. But then there's, of course, very interesting things. And, you know, there's fuzzy logic and vague, concepts of how to be, truly vague in logic. And I think, you know, these are sort of the limits of what we can think about formally as well, you know, on the other side, right? But so talking about more sort of practically, right, the urge to, I guess, or the something fundamental about the perceptual system has this categorical goal, right? Because so much of perception is that's the whole point of it. So
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I distracted you from. You were going back to your notes about the way that you think about this fundamental.
Right. So what? Yeah. So yeah. I wanted to think. I was asking myself, like, what's really behind this, right? So like I said before, you know, what would it mean if a large language model was an adequate theory of X or Y in language or in cognitive science or in neuroscience? And I was trying to think about the kinds of answers that you end up with. And again, to summarize those answers is like, maybe this is not doing justice to the range of things out there, but one of the sort of middle of the road things to say, large language models are a good or good enough model of language processing in the brain or of language representation in the brain. And I want to know more, like, what do people actually mean by that, right? Because they don't, if you say, do you mean that like the brain is a large language model? They would say no, and that's reasonable, no, right? So then what does it actually mean? So then I think, charitably, I think what they mean is that there's some important or meaningful similarity between systems that correlate, right? And this is, again, a little bit what we talked about with the geocentric and heliocentric models, right? They correlate with each other, but they come from fundamentally different claims about the nature of the solar system. But again, as Olivia Guest and I have discussed at length in our papers with multiple realizability, the infinite ways to skin a cat that we've agreed to talk about, infinite ways to cut a cake.
Yeah.
This correlation actually doesn't tell us very much. Most charitably you could say, okay, well then there's got to be some broad strokes, low dimensional similarity, like I said about the time series, or about the fact that, you know, it has all the language data text data ever produced. Yeah. And that language is what is underlying that. The human mind, humans created those data like that. That's in common. But it doesn't tell, it doesn't, for me, that's not an explanation for how language works in the brain. And that's just a different nature of, you know, meaning behind that claim. So that, you know, I think this needs to be analyzed and thought about more carefully. So what, you know, if you say large language models are good models of language in the brain, what does it actually mean? What are the things that that entails in a logical interpretation?
I mean, do you apply the same principle to all of the work in vision with convolutional neural networks being the quote unquote yes. best models of,
yeah. Yes, we would. Although I realize, you know, that's a much more, there's much larger literature and a larger sort of population and tradition of people working on that. And I don't, you know.
Would you say it's more rigorous too, because the findings are correlated to single units, single neurons?
I mean,
you know,
and... I think in the limit, in the logical space, it's not any different. Mm-hmm. But there is something, I would say, inherently beautiful about seeing that correlation sort of extend down to every pin of the, you know, of the system, so to speak. And you see it in that way. And it is, like you said, for some behavioral neuroscientists, enough to really be able to predict every subsequent data step, right?
And Jim DiCarlo would say, and control, like prediction yes. and control is understanding.
Yes, for me, that's engineering, but that's okay. I mean, that's what people think, right?
It's E understanding, engineering understanding or something.
Right? And what we want, I science.
Yeah,
I think, I think it's complicated. I think these debates are really worth having, and I'm very suspicious of myself. And others who have extreme exclusionary views where you say,
right.
Well, okay, maybe that's all we can achieve, right, is prediction and control. But don't you want more, right? I just want more. And I think more is possible. It may not be in the form that we expect, where we think like, okay, and, you know, an explanatory model of making it up, sensory motor control, you know, is we have these boxes and, you know, there's just different forms, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Different levels.
And I don't think that we should, you know, I don't think that the solution is not to say that prediction and control is understanding. I think that's.
But for you personally, because you dive into potential mechanisms in the brain underlying, you know, how.
I try. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, in your theoretical
yes.
approach, I mean, does it matter how the brain, like for you personally to have a satisfactory understanding of how language works in biological cognition in humans, does it matter how the brain does it?
Yes,
that a silly question?
I think there are two aspects to that. So do the particulars of how the brain does it matter? Yes and no, right? So I'm not able to get, I think maybe this is maybe the difference between the DiCarlo prediction and control and is understanding and that's enough, is I had to accept long ago that I would never have perfect prediction or control, right? This is a different state of, you know, of organism and ethical situation,
yeah.
You know, that I don't think that I need to have, I don't want a model, for example, a model of general relativity where I have to know the position of every atom in the universe to know whether my model is correct. That would give me prediction and control, but it would give me no understanding of the principles of the system. But I actually don't, I mean, I would actually say, I mean, I don't know Jim DiCarlo, but I don't think, I think that everyone is actually gaining more than just prediction and control as understanding. They're actually doing inference when they write their papers and think about it. They are in their head trying to glean categories and first principles. They are, that's what the human mind does. That's the human urge that underlies all science, and it has to be refined and honed and carefully carried out to become science. I feel like that's somehow missing out on a core thing. It's actually not actually accurately describing what people are doing, even in vision science, to say that you're just trying to get prediction and control and that's understanding. People are still trying to derive some first principles based on that.
Hmm. You know, I recently had L.A. Pavlik on and Gare Lupien, and there's a lot of people who are, one, just, you know, impressed with the large language models, mm-hmm. of course, we all are. But also like probing them. And I'm not sure where they land on, you know, whether it's a good model for biological cognition. But then, you know, But they're finding, like Ellie Pavlik is finding some symbol-like representations, right, in the large language models. And so they are kind of being used to probe. And there's a lot of people excited about large language models as models of biological cognition.
Well, so can I jump in already? So I would say they're already, there's a different approach. So there's a tradition of having, of instantiating symbols and connections networks that goes back to the 80s and 90s, the work of John Hummel and Alex Dumas and Keith Holyoke. And they're, it's sort of a different, you know, the idea is like, what do we need to use to realize something that's symbolic in the, in a neural network? And the key sort of insight of Alex Dumas's work is that, you know, what do I need? What is a series of algorithms or transformations of information in the internal states of a settling neural network that I need, you know, to predicate something, right? Mm-hmm. To learn structured representations from unstructured data, right? That's the insight of DORA, which I could talk for a long time about. I've lost my train of thought. So the other approach that you're talking about is sort of where, symbols emerge. And then again, as I talked about in the beginning, then you have to do the hard work of like extensively testing this. So then you have to say, okay, what's a symbol? What counts as being a truly symbolic representation? Yeah. And to some degree, previious work, especially in analogy and in categories and concepts literature and in cognitive science, has done this and has established some benchmarks for what that would be. Those are not currently being applied in natural language processing, I think, maybe for historical reasons, or it's taking a while for people to discover that literature again. But I think that's just a very different approach, and it seems more sort of like open-ended, right? So like what if you just haven't found, again, what is that with the black swans and the white swans? You just haven't, you just don't know whether one day one's going to come along, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe you just haven't found the right test. And I think that's I would be much more sort of on shaky ground with that, rather than saying, okay, I've understood the principles of what I need to have a neural network, realize something that's functionally symbolic. Yes, it's important to test that, what the representations are. Do they meet those criteria? But then at least I have a theory about what caused that to occur. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, looking at emergent behavior, that's not to deride that at all. I'm sure that has value. You still don't, in the end, you find those symbolic representations. Well, how did they get there? How do you know, how are they instantiated? Will they always be instantiated the same way? How much are they dependent on the properties of the data that were produced by systems that have symbolic representations, i.e. humans?
Sure. I see I scratched an itch there, or maybe caused an itch with this, specific to symbols. But, I was bringing it up as a, which I'm glad you went down that road. But I was just bringing it up because the question was, where do you land on what the usefulness of like a large language model in their current instantiation? Are they useless to think about biological cognition? Like, what do you see there?
Yeah, I think the links to biological cognition are most tenuous. I think the closest link is through the data, which, we don't always know everything about, and the training regime, which we don't always know everything about, but mostly through the data, because that is produced by the system we're trying to study. But it's like, mm-hmm. through how many filters do you want to study the system? Okay, so I guess large language models have two aspects that people would deem important for studying, right? So they have the behavior that humans have, right? So let's say that they produce
impressive output.
Right. Let's say that. That's the one thing that they have to study. They don't have any of the other constraints that we have. So if we think maybe there's something, maybe that is telling us what in the limit is learnable from data that we don't get exposed to as humans or as children. But I don't think it's useful or productive to sound completely negative about this, but I'm really just honestly saying my point of view is I just don't see the links, because they have not been constrained in a rigorous way. I understand the urge to say, oh yeah, it's a great model organism for language, but it doesn't, I don't know, it's a bit like saying, a model organism for a mouse would be like some output of like all the mouse behaviors and like a space with like, how much of could you know about them, what we know about, maybe the mouse is too high up, but about, I don't know, isn't it C. elegans that we have the full connectome of? Mm-hmm. Of course, you can debate about whether that's actually even the right readout to be caring about, but I think it's useful to think about, for what other system, if you were to make a large language model of it, would you be satisfied studying that object?
Well, I think the curiosity is just how well these deep learning models are performing without having been built generally you know, like with the constraints of organismal.
But they were specifically built to do this task, right, that they're doing. And then they are exquisitely tuned now with human feedback. And they are given the, basically the prerogative, impress us, give me a response that can't be the training data, but that is a really good approximation of it. And of course, it can do that at all is deeply impressive. But without, you know, we don't know about the leakage. We don't know about how much, you know, the training and the test data is completely blurred. We don't know the role of human feedback. We know that there's so many other things about the models that violate our beliefs about what a tenable system is. They're ethically very fraught. I mean, that's something that is not my expertise, but that I'm very aware of, that there are so many ethical issues that come up with these. And that they really amplify power structures. There's all sorts of complicated, important work about that. I feel like I'm letting you down not being an enthusiast, but I'm just...
Why are you so negative, Andrea? This is great.
So
because
positive
it's kind
about
of...
manifold, so negative about large language models.
And large language models have zero manifolds.
That's a question.
No, I know. Yeah.
I don't have...
You can make anything into a manifold,
that's
though.
That's one of the weaknesses of manifolds and gradients. Anything can be a gradient.
Right.
Whenever I see gradient work, I'm always like, but anything can be a gradient. But anyway, but I do think that it would be, you know, I thought about doing this. I think I'm not sure that it's worth it. But that, you know, looking at the dynamics of large language models, they're going to be very, very different.
So you don't feel like... So you are tempted to sort of probe, look more into large language models for your own negative reasons, of course.
Yeah, but I don't... I've tried... You know, Alex and I did some work where we made Dora, the settling neural network model that can learn predicates, play... Pong after being trained on Breakout and vice versa. And it can do that because it learns relational representations. Mm-hmm. And we did a whole series of stuff where we learned relational representations from the Clever data set and then played these games. And the way that the work it was just so difficult to communicate what we were trying to say. There's such a, I feel like not being completely enthusiastic and on board with large language models is already a quite difficult position to be in. And I feel like my own work in my own case is not often, served by, being negative, but I also don't, I can't, and this is what I think. So I just try to say what I think and be kind about it.
But do you feel like that large language model world is encroaching on your approach, you know?
I feel like, and that the reason why, you know, I feel sort of that I will engage with them because I can't not, they're everywhere.
Loud.
And I think they're loud. And, you know, when with manuscripts and for my students and my team, you know, I have a responsibility, and I want to put them in the best position to grow their talent and go where they can go. And I'm not going to hold them back, you know, because of my own beliefs, right? So it's an interactive process, and we always tend to end up on the same page. I mean, I've never had any huge disagreements in my own team. It's actually quite. I mean, there's many ways to explain that, but my point is more. I don't think it sets already coming into a polarized debate, and also I don't know. I think maybe someone who's different from me, if they were advocating my position, might be received differently. I can never know about that. Mm. So I try to just talk, say what I think, say it in an accessible way, not disparage people's entire research programs, but yet say what I think needs to be said. And it's not, it's not easy. I'll say that. It's not always clear what the right thing to do is.
So it also makes you more unique that you're not walking down the path that everyone seems to be walking down, right? In terms of mentorship and guiding your students, I mean, there's value to being unique, right? And just not falling into the large language model trap.
From my experience, can go back and forth on this. It doesn't necessarily always go over well. You don't always get heard, or you get misinterpreted, or sometimes you just sort of get excluded because it's not, how do you engage with that? Mm-hmm. These are all sort of the dynamics of all human activities, science, politics, life.
Yay, exactly.
But I do feel like it's important for my students to, it says there's a bit of a learning process in that as well. So, how do you defend what you really think, and how do you do it in a way that people will listen to some degree? How do you do it in a way that doesn't exclude you completely from everybody
else? You change
else?
Oscillations to neural dynamics is one thing.
You don't talk about evolution. You talk about appearances. No, I don't advocate any of this. I'm just, you know, I'm figuring out as I go. It's not easy. But for example, like for funders, I'm very aware that, you know, talking about language models in the brain probably won't be seen as timely or contemporary if you don't have something to say about large language models.
Oh, yeah. So can't just cast them off.
No. And I feel like that's also sort of not, it is also a moment where language is in the public's view a lot more. And so that's actually good for language sciences and for neuroscience in the end too. So it's a way of engaging with that and trying to make the best of it without, you know, compromising one's principles. And so, yeah, I guess I won't ever go on the record saying I think that there's like, you know, something exciting that's going to change everything. I think, again, for what I've said, you know, when we say that these models are enough, we're saying that behavior is more important. And it's not even behavior in the sense of human behavior. I don't even want to make that equivalence, that a certain, you know, sequence processing or grammatical strings is more important, that are contextually licensed or however you can make them more generous in your description, that's the most important thing about a model, not what it explains. And maybe from a prediction and controls enough, that's understanding. Maybe those two things align, right?
All right, Andrea, I've taken you far enough, and we've walked down a hierarchy of manifolds, and
we have.
We didn't even get to everything that
I know.
That
I feel like we could have done. You know, there are many other manifolds we could have explored.
A lot of manifolds, and maybe another time. I'd love to have you back another time. But
thank you. I'd love to.
I appreciate you figuring all this out for us, and continued success doing
thank
that.
You. So,
and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks so much for reading my work. It was really wonderful to hear you talk about it, that you got it right away. It meant so much to me. Thank you.
I alone produce Brain Inspired. If you value this podcast, consider supporting it through Patreon to access full versions of all the episodes and to join our Discord community. Or if you want to learn more about the intersection of neuroscience and AI, consider signing up for my online course, NeuroAI, The Quest to Explain Intelligence. Go to braininspired.co to learn more. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. You're hearing music by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time.